Okay, good. We'll edit that. So you just get to enjoy the fun. So we're still working it out. And here's who we are. We don't pretend to say that we have it all together. We're a work in progress. And we're okay with saying that because here's the reality. I'm not perfect. You're not perfect. Our sound system's not perfect. Nothing's perfect about anything that we do. We just try to give our best to God, to just bring him the praise and glory of what he's doing. And so today we're beginning a new series called Who Really Needs God? And the reason for the series is to bring out in the open some of the things that people are really talking and thinking about. For the last 30 years, we've observed an increasing number of people that are stepping away from God. And so rather than ignore it, which is kind of what the church does on a lot of topics, I want to be a church that does some different things. I want to talk about real topics that we're thinking about and dealing with on a regular basis. And so I want to do that. And so today, The topic that I'm going to just work through is stepping away from God, and I want to look at two things, and you can track this through with me. First thing is, should we be talking about it, number one? Some people say, you shouldn't talk about some of this stuff. You go to church, and you shouldn't be talking about this, and so the first question is, should we talk about it? And then the second thing is, what are people stepping into when they step away from God? You understand that, right? Whenever you go somewhere, you're stepping to a place. So what is it that people are stepping toward if you step away from God? And so we're going to work through this. So the first thing, should we be talking about people's view of God? Many of you are probably raised in a way where you're not supposed to talk about God with different people or talk about religion with different people. You don't talk about politics. You don't talk about religion. So you kind of keep those things separate from everything else. You can talk about the Sixers and how good they're doing, yes? Okay, some of you are like, who's the Sixers? I don't know. It's a football team you should be watching. But anyway, it's basketball. I'm kidding. And you talk about all kinds of other things, but the reality is we leave religion or we leave politics out of the conversation, and we don't want to talk about that. We're not going to talk about politics because that's not fun right now, but we'll talk about God. And should we be talking about people's view of God? So here's where I come back to, and it's a circular argument for sure for me to do this, but it's the best argument I could come up with. So in a circular kind of a way, I'll go back and say, should we talk about God? Well, what's God say about it? Well, that's circular, right? And so I'll go back and I'll say, okay, what does someone in God's word say about it? What do they do? And so I'll go back to, there's several different passages I could go to, but for sake of time, I've eliminated all the ones except for one. So in Acts chapter 17, in your Bible, it's in the New Testament, it's this book called Acts, which is essentially the acts or the action of what God was doing in the first generation of believers, the first church, if you will. And so in that first generation, this guy Luke, who is a physician and also a historian, who wrote down the different things that were going on and analyzed things and helped us to be able to see what was going on, he wrote these things down for us to be able to understand. So in Acts chapter 17 then, we get to seeing this one guy whose name was Saul, and then because of his relationship, I'll say milestone moment with God, he had his name then changed from Saul to what? To Paul. Some of you knew that, okay? And so this guy, he was responsible for writing most of the New Testament. He was a person that grew up in a Hebrew or a Jewish tradition. He was schooled very highly in Hebrew law. He memorized probably most of what we would call the first five books of the Bible and most of the Old Testament, as we call it. He knew most of this in and out. He's a very educated person. And so we track through his life, and we can see his life for several years after he began to follow God, and follow Jesus, we'll say. And after that point, you see him go through different regions, and he's planting churches just like this. Goes into little towns like Ephesus or Corinth or Galatia, and regions of Galatia, and different places where he's planting churches. And so his background is Hebrew, Jewish. That's what he's trained in, so you would expect that the only people he would be effectively dialoguing with would be Jewish people. And in Acts chapter 17, we see him in a different light in verse 16. As he's going through, we see him in this area. He says, well, now while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him, as he saw that the city was full of idols. Now, idols are very simply, there are statues or different things that are representing other gods, small g gods, okay? And so he sees this whole city filled with these idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews, which is what we would expect him to do. And he reasons with them and the devout persons in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. And this was his normal pace of life. He loved a good debate. He didn't like a good argument, but he liked a good debate. He loved to discuss things and talk about God with people in all kinds of different places. And so he's there in the synagogue and in the marketplace. But then in verse 18, it says, some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him and said, what does this babbler wish to say? Others said, he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. So who's he now talking to? He's not talking to Jewish people. Now he's talking to people that have a totally different perspective. These are people that we would call more on the agnostic kind of a range. Or they would have many gods in front of them. They're like, I don't know which one's the real one to follow. So we'll just discuss this and dialogue about all these different things. And so they set this up at Areopagus. And so in verse 19, that's where he goes, and he says, may we know that this new what this new teaching is that you are presenting. So they're like, hey, listen, we've got all these other gods, and we've got all these idols over here. We knew you're Jewish, you're from that descent, and now you got this new thing going on. This is not what we expected you to be teaching. And so they're having this new dialogue with him. And so he's in verse 21, he continues, and all the Athenians and the foreigners who live there, they would spend their time in nothing except telling and hearing something new. And that's what they wanted for. Now let's pause for a moment. How comfortable would you feel in an arena like that? Where it's people that all they study is philosophy and all they study is other gods and other religions. And they love to ask you questions. And maybe you know some friends like this, right? Maybe you're that person that asks these deep questions. And, well, what do you think about that? And how do you feel about that? And I don't know about you, but there's times where I'll get into these conversations with people that are really intelligent, like educated way beyond the typical person. And you get nervous, like they're going to ask me something that I'm just not sure how to answer. Have you ever felt that way? Some of you are nodding, and others are like, I'm not sure if I should nod because I'm concerned, you know? Here's the reality. I think we all feel that way. And here's Paul in a conversation with people that are not like him at all. They didn't grow up Jewish, per se. They didn't grow up believing in Jesus. They believe in all kinds of different things, and they love to just think and think and think and talk about what they're thinking about, and they love to question you and kind of push things out as to what they feel and say or think. And so that's where we find Paul. And here's my summary point with all of this. Here's Paul, one who has written most of the New Testament, one who we would say he's somebody that's a true follower of Jesus. He's someone that really believes in God. And here's someone who's not afraid to have a dialogue with people that think totally different. Whether they're agnostic, whether they're atheist, whether they believe in all kinds of different gods, or whether they're just kind of eclectic and they believe some and don't believe others, he was totally willing to have a conversation. And not simply a conversation of, let me just tell you what to think and argue my point, but in a conversation where he's willing to have a dialogue. And what I see down here further as he dialogues with them, and I'll just read this through a little bit so they can see what's going on. Verse 22, it says, so Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, so he's standing there in their kind of courtroom, says, men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. And did he say it right? Yeah, they believe in something. I mean, we're all religious to a degree, but they're really religious. They've got everything there. He says, for as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with the inscription, to the unknown God. What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. Now he's having an intellectual conversation about the gods that they are worshiping and about some that they don't even know who they are worshiping. It's fascinating. So here's my point. He has learned enough to know how to have an honest and real conversation with people that don't believe in Jesus. To me, this is one of the biggest arguments for me to be aware of what's out there. To understand that just because I think it doesn't mean everybody's going to think this way. Plus, if people see it differently than where I'm at, I should probably figure out where they are. It's kind of like this. My favorite truck to drive is a GM product. I prefer a Chevy or a GMC. GMC, I think, is even better than the Chevy because it has different options, but that's just besides the point. Now, if all I ever drove was a GMC, and I'll just kind of inflate it a little bit, 2,500, we'll go diesel, right? Four-door cab, 8-foot bed. Okay, you with me? How many are like, oh, I'm tracking with you? Like, give a grunt. The rest of you are like, what is he talking about? It's a really cool truck, okay? Blue, like, it'd be really cool. And okay, so you're with me. No payments. Okay, now you're with me here. So if that's all I ever drove, okay, and you came up with your Toyota Tundra, and I'm like, that's a baby truck. That's not even a for real truck. Like, get out of here. The real truck drivers have a Chevy or a GMC, and that's all we have. And you kind of just sit in there. And then what I do is I proclaim this so much that my friends can only be, sorry, Matt, you're out. The Jeep people gone. My friends can only be GMC people that have a GMC Sierra 2500. I mean, I'll let the 1500s come in because, you know, you're kind of like driving a baby truck, which is what I'm driving technically. But, you know, and I'll let you kind of into my thing and maybe you'll grow up and get a real truck someday kind of thing. And so we have that kind of mentality of it's only going to be this particular group that can hang with me. And that's all we ever talk about. We never find out that Ford came up with a truck that might be a good rival to it. Or we might come up find out that, hey, they came out with something that might be better or whatever. And we never actually have a conversation with anybody that drives anything other than a GMC. Does that make sense? In church world, oftentimes what we do is we have GMC mentality. They say, this is the only way it's ever going to, we're not going to talk about anything other than what we've traditionally always felt, thought, taught, and that's it. Here, Paul is having a dialogue. That doesn't mean it always changes your mind to have a dialogue with. And it doesn't mean it has to change your mind to be influenced or to understand what other people are thinking. What it means is you should rationally, intelligently be thinking through things that you may or may not agree with as well. And so that's what we're working through. So I'll say, yes, we should talk about it. I see Paul doing it. I see other places in the Bible that you'd say, okay, they're doing this as well. They're very well informed about the culture that's around them. And so let's talk about it. Why? Why in the world would I want to talk about this? Do you want to talk about this? Here's why I want to talk about this. Do you realize that the United States now ranks third among nations that have people that are away from or not following God, that don't want anything to do with God? They rank third past China, which is fascinating to me in that we used to be a nation that was founded, quote unquote, on Christian principles, and there's a lot of history dialogue there, but Christianity used to be the mainstay of America. And now we're at a point where we're not there anymore. As a matter of fact, we're so far down the chain that you would say we're really a lost nation in comparison. We're a nation that doesn't want or doesn't have anything to do with God, and that's where we're moving. We would call us an unreached people group, in a sense, of people that don't know God. And when you look at the next generation really has very little knowledge of who God is. Why? Well, there's a lot of reasons why. And so for me, I say, let's talk about it. Do you know that in church world, half of the churches in America had zero growth in the past 2 years, in a sense of had no new members in the last 2 years from what Gallup polls and others have researched. 85% of the churches, so 85, if you get an 85 in class, is that a good or bad grade? Okay, depends who you are. For me, that was awesome. I'm like, yes! I got a C, I'm average. And for some of you, like my daughter who like loves A's, like she would cry if she got an 85. I'm like, what's wrong with you? I'm like, yeah, it's great. Anyway, 85% of churches are plateaued or declining. That's a sad statistic. What that means is there's very little growth in church world. Certainly there's mega churches, and that's becoming something that's happened over the past 20 years, but that really does not balance things out at all as far as growth goes. And you can do more research there, but we just won't. In Camden County alone, just to research our little area, the statistics they've collected about religion says that in 2000, the year 2000, about 184,000 people declared that they were nuns. They, not N-U-N-S, okay, that'd be a lot of nuns walking around. N-O-N-E-S, okay, got to make sure you understand and spell this correctly. But there was 184,000 people that declared themselves non-religiously affiliated. That's in the year 2000. In the year 2010, they did this again, and as they discovered this, there was that in that group, there was about 240,000. Now think about this. Those numbers, you're like, I don't understand those numbers. If your house, if you bought your house in the year 2000 for $184,000, and 10 years later, you did nothing to it, and it was now worth $240,000, does the math make a little more sense to you? Now let's flip that around, because some of you have experienced this. You bought your house for $240,000, and then 10 years later, it's only worth $184,000. How backwards are you on your mortgage now? Right? Like, somebody bail me out. And that's where I'm looking at the church today. It's that you've had over 50,000 people in 10 years' time that have said, I'm through with the church. I don't even want to declare that I'm anywhere near the church. I used to, but I don't want to now. So while the population of America is increasing in the same period of time, it's increased 25 million people in 10 years. 25 million. Can you even understand that? If I give you a check for 25 million, could you understand that? I couldn't give you a check for 25 million. It'd be worthless, okay? I'm just saying, okay? I know you're thinking, well, he's one of those pastors, really? No, I'm not. 25 million people are added into America in 10 years, but the church population is actually on decline. Not by a little bit, but by a large margin. Should we talk about this group that's leaving the church? In our church here, because we're friends and because I talk to so many different people that are here, and there's several that are here for the first time, so glad that you're here, and there's a lot of people joining in on Facebook or on YouTube and watching and listening to this as well, and we're so glad that you do this and check things out. I don't normally stand this still, but because of the mic I am. So anyway, here's the different groups that attend here, and I'll just put it up here and you can see the different groups. There's a group that believes in God, and they want to convince others to believe in God. And I would imagine that the majority of our congregation is made up of people that believe in God and want to convince others to believe in God. But then going down away from that, you would have people that still believe in God, but they struggle with some things. Listen, teens, if you're in school, I would almost guarantee that most teens are right here. You believe in God, you're going to church, you go to youth group, you're hanging out at this place, and you've been taught to believe in God, but the reality is that you struggle with certain things that we'll talk about in the series. Or you're the third one, you're not sure what to believe, and maybe it's your first time coming, maybe you saw what we were doing, you're like, I want to check this out. They're actually going to talk about whether you should believe in God. I'm going to check this out and figure some things out, and maybe that's where you are, that you're not sure what to believe, and so you're just coming to check things out. Or maybe you're here on a weekly basis or monthly basis just to check this out and say, I don't know, and different things. or the fourth one, they don't care about what to believe in. They just don't care. Like, this conversation is just, can we hurry up, please, Pastor? I don't really care about this. I'm just enjoying the coffee that was free in the back. That's as far as I really wanted to go here today. And you're saying that in your mind, in a sense, but you wouldn't verbalize that. And there's a lot of people that are in this category today. And then the last one I would say is they don't believe anymore, but still show up sometimes. They don't believe anymore. For whatever reason, you say, I don't believe anymore, but you still show up. Listen, here's what I'm going to say. No matter what category you're in, I am glad that you're here. I am so thrilled that you're here. And I hope that in this series we can resolve some of these things and help you to understand who God is a little bit more. So here's, as we see this, people are simply stepping away from church. And then we see, secondly, people are stepping away from God. They're stepping away from God. On September 11th, 2001, something significant happened in America. We had a terrorist attack on American soil that took thousands of people's lives. And you say, well, what does this have to do with God? Just watch. In that time, the following week, there was a surge of people that came out to churches just like this in churches across America, period. And there's statistics literally done on this, and it's estimated that about half of the adult population attended church the week after 9/11, which is a big jump. While 49% say that they would be of some sort of religion, not many go to church. And there's a lot of people like that. I was talking to people this week. They're saying, well, I'm this religion, but I haven't been to church in like 10 years, you know? And so it's interesting. So in 2001, the week after 9/11, it's estimated that about half the adult population attended church. So what happened then after that is interesting. That in record time, a few weeks later, by November, the statistics for November was that the attendance that was up here had dropped significantly, dropped back to where it was prior to 9/11. It's a fascinating statistic. It was in record time, back in World War I, World War II, and different other events that you would see in America's past. There's some statistics that were done around that you'd see this curve that's going up of people attending church because they're like, man, we need God. God's got to do something here. And you had people come, and it stayed for longer, 6 months, a year, year and a half, 2 years, and then it would slowly trickle down. But in this, at 9/11, the trickle down was not a trickle down. Ed Young, a pastor of a megachurch down in Texas, he talks about this time and he gives the honest statistics where it was the highest Sunday that had ever been at the church there as far as attendance goes. The following week, it dropped thousands. And it's a megachurch, it's over 20,000 people, but it dropped thousands. And the following week, it dropped thousands more. What happened? Well, during that time, I think people finally said, okay, well, we're going to check out God. Like, he's kind of like our good luck charm, I guess, or whatever it is. It's we're scared, we're nervous, let's go see what God has. Let's go to church, let's do something in that kind of a way. And I can't pretend to think I know what everybody was thinking in their minds, but at that time, Sam Harris, a philosopher and neuroscientist, began writing a book called The End of Faith. The End of Faith. And I want to ask you for a raise of hands as to how many have read this book. And I'm going to refer to several different books. But in this book, it was a scathing critique of all religion. 12 publishers, think about this, 12 publishers turned him down. They did not want to, they were not going to publish this book. Finally, one of them published this book. And in a fascinating turn of events, when it was published, it was on the New York Times bestseller. New York Times bestseller. For 33 weeks. What does that say? Well, you have 9/11 happening right here. Within just, really, it's months later, this book comes out. You have people that are leaving the church, and now you see people that are leaving God. And they're looking and they're saying, okay, I want to figure this out. And he's talking about the end of faith, and it really is a scathing critique on religion altogether. And he has follow-up books of that as well that you could be able to check out and understand what he's saying all the way through. He's not simply saying religion is something that I disagree with. He's saying religion is terrifying. Religion is something we should run from. Religion should be outlawed. He's really going to that length, as well as others that were writing in that day as well, not that long ago. So you have other books that are published at the same time. This would be probably the biggest book, The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. And so in that, Richard Dawkins, he makes a case for belief in that the belief in God is not just wrong, but is harmful and potentially deadly. I mean, this is a full onslaught of saying, I have a real problem with any kind of a religion. And there's reasons, and we're going to talk about that today. If you're thinking I'm bashing these books, I'm really not. I'm looking at these guys are smart, smart people. And so I'm just highlighting what's going on. And then you have Christopher Hitchens, who writes another one, God is Great. I don't need to describe it because he does in his title, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Do you see where we're heading here? These books, by the way, they're bestsellers. If you go on Amazon and look at them, they have thousands of five-star reviews, thousands. This isn't just a curiosity thing. This is people that there's a movement, not simply away from church, but away from God. Okay? So should we be talking about this? I think we're kind of crazy not to. Does that make sense? It's easy to conclude that with the drop of church attendance and the increased attention toward atheism and anti-God writings, that people are stepping away from God. And so the big question is why? Why are people stepping away from God? And in this series, we're going to look at different aspects, so I would encourage you to keep coming back and checking things out here, because I'm going to highlight several things over the next 6 weeks. So then the next question is, what are people stepping into when they step away from God? What are they stepping into when you step away from God? Where are you heading? What's the logical or the rational conclusion of where you're going to go if you step away from God? And here's the reality. Now think about this. You never step away from something without stepping towards something. Would you agree? You don't step away from something without stepping into something. So you can't just be neutral and be like, well, I'm stepping away from God and it's okay. The reality is if you step away from God, you're stepping into something totally different. And so here's what I want to do. If you're considering stepping away from God, I want you to see where you're heading. Or if you know someone that's considering stepping away from God, I want you to know where they're heading. And I want you to see it not from my lens, not from my perspective. And here's what I'm going to do. Some of you are like, okay, so you're getting back into the Bible. Here's what I'm doing. You ready? I'm closing my Bible for the rest of our time today. Next week, I'll make up for it. Okay? So you're like, well, he just hardly read in the Bible. You'll see. Next week, we'll get back to this, okay? I want you to see what other people are saying, because I want you to see if you are stepping away from God and people are stepping away from God, where are they or where are you heading? And it's not from me. I want to go to the leading atheists and what they are saying. So where would I get that information from? The books that I just noted and several others that have been written about this. So I'm taking from them. I'm not doing anything other than just taking from them. Here's what they are saying. So the first one, they'll talk about several illusions. There's an illusion of the mind. An illusion of the mind. The mind is an illusion. You are simply chemistry and biology that's controlled by neurological and biological chemical processes. And for some, you're like, I'm tuning out, man. These words are just too big for me. It's okay. Just pause and stay with me. Let me illustrate what that means, okay? In 2013, there's a study that found, a study of these different girls. They found this specific oxytocin receptor gene. I had to read that, okay? That these girls felt more lonely in the presence of judgmental friends than did girls without this gene. These results, they suggest that at least some of what they were perceived as free responses are being determined by our biology. So here's what, let me kind of pull this back and explain. So they would study these different girls, and when the girls would feel judged or they would feel kind of infringed upon, those that did not have this gene responded totally different than girls that did have this gene. The responses were different. And so you'd look at that and they would say, okay, it was basically what gives you that drive to go toward this line of thinking is this genetic predisposition or this genetic or this biological thing that you have going on inside of you. And so it's essentially not a mind thing that you're doing. It's not that you're mentally going in this direction. It's not you're choosing. It's that it's choosing you. So if you feel, when you're feeling judged and they say, you know, what do you think of this dress on me? And I'll just say it in a judgmental way. Well, you could look kind of fat with that. Well, if you have that gene, now you feel like they don't like me and you fall apart and you start to cry, okay? And the other person that doesn't have that gene, they're like, oh, okay, let me try something else on. Now, I'm not going to ask the raise of hands which one you are, okay? We're not going to do that. But you follow the train of thought as to where they're heading with this, okay? And so what they're saying then, and I'm giving a very kind of bland way of saying that or illustrating that, but what they're saying then is, if you, because of that research, then you have really no mind as to the choice as to how you will respond. Does that make sense? Some of you are still like getting there? Okay. And so they conclude then that the mind does not have a choice but to be the responder to what your body has been programmed to do. It's kind of like a computer. It's kind of like your GPS device. You're just going to go this direction because you have to. So your mind, then, is an illusion. And they would get into that in different ways. Now, here's the second illusion. For sake of time, I'm going to fly through. Well, I could talk about these all for really the whole time each, but I'm just highlighting so you can do some research on your own. The second one is the illusion of free will. The illusion of free will. Do we have the ability to choose the direction that we're going on, going with life? Yes or no? How many say yes? How many say no? Okay? Awesome. In a controversial set of experiments, this is going back to 1985. The reason I'm going back is because this is the kind of the beginning of the discussion here, and there's been a lot of research that's happened since then. So neuroscientist Ben LeBay, in 1985, scanned participants' brains as he instructed them to move their arm. So he's saying, hey, move your arm, and if you're sitting there, the brain thing is attached, and you're going, okay, moving the arm. So what would you expect as conclusion if you're doing this based on your will to choose to move your arm? The expectation is move your arm. Brain goes, blah, and then your arm goes, okay? Without the sound effects, but the sound effects are really cool, okay? So he found that brain activity increased even before the participants were aware of their decision to move their arm. So here, the brain was moving, in a sense, in a different kind of way than that he expected. It was opposite. So LeBay, he interpreted that these findings as the meaning that brain had somehow decided to make the movement and that the person became consciously aware of this decision only after it had already been made. So the neuroscientists in that day, and even today, they're using this to say that you don't have a will. Basically, they're not thinking and doing. It just is instantaneously happening. Just boom. It's I did move my arm without thinking. My arm's already going that direction. So without my brain, it's just already there. And that's the finding. So essentially, atheists then would argue that we have no free will. Now, for the majority of you that just said you have free will, the atheist would say, no, you don't. You are subject to whatever is going on inside of you. And if you're theologically a hyper-Calvinist, you'd actually agree with them too, but I'm not going to go there because it's not where we're going to go today. Anyway, so essentially what happens was determined to happen, and we have no real control over it. Do you follow me? Nobody said yes, so it's because you're predetermined not to say yes? Okay, good. Okay, so it's like the atheist that falls down the steps. Let me illustrate. An atheist falls down the steps. They go all the way down 13 or 14 steps. They get to the bottom and tumble, 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 and they get to the bottom, and they get up, and they kind of shake it off, and like, oh. And then they say, boy, I'm glad I got that over with. because it's predetermined for me to fall down the steps. And if you need to respond, do you follow where I'm at? Okay. Interestingly, Stephen Hawking, an advocate for determinism, he says, I've noticed that even people who claim that everything is predestined and that we can do nothing to change it, which is, he's a strong proponent for it, and he's way brilliant, okay? Just passed away just a little while ago. He says, those people that they claim that everything is predestined, that we can do nothing to change it, they look before they cross the road. There's a logical fallacy. Do you see that? So the natural conclusion, then, is to argue that we aren't responsible for our actions because we are simply a pawn to our neurochemical and biological chemical processes. So, when he cheated, he couldn't help himself. That's where we're heading. That's where this is leading us to. When she bought too much, she couldn't help herself. And when they drank too much, well, they couldn't help themselves. Do you see where we're heading? You have no free will. It's just you're responding to your biological chemical processes. And in psychology, medication then is the only hope. It's the only hope. Why? Think about this. If you do not have a free will, then in psychology, if you see a psychologist or a counselor, the end result, the greatest hope is that they have some kind of a pill or some kind of medication that helps to change the chemical processes so that you can be the person that you desire to be. That's where this is heading. So, you don't have a choice but to be depressed unless you have medication to change that. You don't have a choice but to be angry and to lash out at that cashier that gave you one penny difference in the change because it just happened. It was just there. I couldn't control it. The chemical process, it just went and there it is. So you don't have even personal responsibility. The addict does not have a choice in the matter. They're an addict because they're made that way. And certainly we can get into other issues as well that I'm not going to dialogue about yet. So, essentially, there is no hope for change. The only reason why you come to church is to feel something. So that however many percentage that said, no, I think that I can change, I have a free will, you just think you have a free will. Do you see that? That's the end argument. And so here's the problem. For an atheist, if you're moving that direction, if someone hurts you, if they cheated, if they spent too much, if they drank too much, they smoked too much, you have no reason to be angry. How could you be mad at somebody for something that they can't control that they're doing? Do you see it? If you have no free will, and you're just a responder to your biological chemical processes, then I'm not going to get mad at you for being angry and throwing something at me. I'm just going to smile and say, oh, that was just your response and your reaction. That's just what's going on in your brain. And yep, you smoke too much. You drink too much. I know it's okay. And and that's where we're at. And so what you do is you set up a system or a place where you have enough rules in place to keep people from doing harm with their chemical processes. Okay. That's another one that I didn't get into. But we'll move on. Next, number three. So that's the illusion of free will. The illusion then of value. Value. Value implies some sort of worth. If I were to give you a pound of steel or a pound of gold, which one would you prefer? How many would prefer the steel? Okay, how many would prefer the gold? Okay, that kind of makes sense, right? Why? Because I'm choosing to value one thing over another, and that's in that kind of sense. But in a different sense, you'd have no value, in a sense, to value a person over an animal or over a tree. Do you see that? That's where we're heading. So in a world governed by physics and biological processes, there can be no inherent value. How can you have any value if we're all just processing things? If we're just math and biology and chemistry or whatever. If that's where we are, there's no inherent value. It's just ascribed or assigned value. It's that we assign. And here's the funny thing. Why is gold valuable? That's just because somebody assigned it value. Wouldn't it be cool if somebody assigned steel the same value as gold? That's just because we ascribed it. Now, in a person kind of sense, and different things, you ascribe different things more valuable than others. So we'll ascribe humans better, or you ascribe animals better, or you ascribe trees better, or whatever. You find that, and you just, it's a personal choice of saying this has more value than the other one. So if physics is the foundation, then the only thing that could ascribe value has no potential to do it. Because my mind cannot go there, because it doesn't work. My free will cannot go there, because why am I making this choice? I mean, you follow this all the way through, and then you have a fallacy here within this, that there's an illusion of value that you'd say, well, I could ascribe value. How can you ascribe value at all? Is really what we come back to. So values, they simply, and to kind of walk this a little bit further, values inform my morality. They inform me as to, okay, I want to have a good marriage, so therefore I'm not going to cheat, right? Values inform my finances. I want to have money for retirement, so therefore I'm not going to spend everything on going out and partying today, or I'm not going to go to the movies, I'm not going to go to get dinner, and I'm not going to do all of this and spend everything today. I'm going to save for the future, so because I value that in the future. So values, they inform your morality, it informs your choices that you make, and ultimately then it drives your legacy. So to say that a person or an animal or anything else has more or less value would be a false statement to an atheist. So we naturally then, we came into the world and describe my opinion, my life, my reputation, or anything around me, any value would be simply misleading. So to me, I'm just giving my personal perspective on this. This leads me into depression. It would lead me like, oh, really? There's no value? If I have no value, then I simply exist for existence's sake. Now, that doesn't mean that it's wrong. That's just my personal take. And I value my opinion because it's always right. I'm joking. Then the last one, the illusion of origin. The illusion of origin. It's that something came from no thing. Something came from no thing. Darwin explains the process of life's development, and that's taught and thought and such in all kinds of realms today. And so he explains the process of life's development, but he does not attempt to explain the origin of matter, time, the laws of physics, and chemistry. So essentially, the first life came from no life and no help. Came from no life. The first life, the first thing to come into existence came from no life whatsoever and no help. What steered those things to come into a big bang, or steer those things into what has happened? So natural selection, very simply, and I'm fast-forwarding through a lot of different things here, just to give you highlights. So natural selection, then, moves without a driver. Have you ever seen a car move without a driver? Okay, it doesn't go so well, right? Yeah, sometimes we think our teens... No, I'm just not going there. Natural selection, it moves without a driver, it chooses without a chooser, and it's relentless without a purpose. Do you see that? In that it's relentlessly moving in a direction that it's always getting better. But there's nothing driving that. So there's a lot of things that are simply unexplained, and some things that we say, okay, this is what it is. And so here's all I'm doing. I'm saying here's where you're heading. If you walk away from God, if you're stepping away from God, if you're just taking one step and saying, look, I got to get away from God. I want to try this out and go a different direction. Here is what the brains of the operation, the guys that know way more than you and me, here's what they say. Now for me, listen, honestly, I struggle with all of these things. I'm not a biologist. I'm not a geneticist. I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm a pastor. I have a master's degree in theology, not biology. You follow me? These guys have their PhDs in all kinds of areas. I've read and I've reread many of these books to be able to wrap my mind around it and to say, am I missing something? What is it that they have that they're saying? Is there something to be gained from this? And there's such a following of people, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people. And I look at the next generation, and there's a fast forward toward this place. And so I'm like, okay, I'm not going to sit here and not read and understand. I want to read and understand to the best that I can. And there's a lot out there to continue to. And I've just scratched the surface. And maybe you're in there and you're like, well, I've scratched the surface too, and you're just kind of getting there. I get it. And I'm not calling them dumb because they're not. I'm just saying that their conclusions are concerning. So where do we go from here? Breathe. My goal today was to share to you what it looks like to step away from God. Very simply. That was my goal today. Should we be talking about this? Yes. And I just want to say, here's what it looks like to step away from God. You end up with no mind, no choice, no value, and essentially no life. That's the direction of moving away from God, to step away from God. And here's my thought, and we'll get into this more next week. Perhaps, people are stepping away from God not because atheism looks so appealing, but because their version of theism looks so unappealing. What if the conclusions that you or your friend are holding on to aren't the right conclusions? Well, I want to talk about these things the next few weeks. I'm going to work through them in an honest way and dive in as deep as we can in the time that we have here. We have a discussion group on Sunday nights at 6 o'clock. You're welcome to join. There's certainly a limited space of people that we can have in this space, and we want to have a respectful, honest, open discussion. And maybe you can't make it at that time, and you say, well, I'd like to have a discussion a little bit further. Why? Because we're talking about serious, serious things that are happening in school, in our community, in work, and at home. This affects every area. It affects why lawgivers and lawmakers are making the laws that they do. It affects where we're heading in so many different ways. And so we need to be informed, we need to understand, and we need to understand then what do we do with the information. And so we want to dive into that. I hope, it is my desire, that I've whetted your appetite enough and challenged you enough to think. And maybe if you're going that direction, maybe if you're saying, I want to take a step away from God, maybe I've caused you enough room to pause and say, let me think a little bit more before I walk away from God. Or maybe you're three steps away. Maybe today I've just caused you just to stop for a second and say, maybe I need to rethink some of my conclusions. Or maybe you know somebody it is. And you say, wow, I didn't see that's what they keep saying. Now I get it a little bit more. So I hope that you'll keep coming back for the next few weeks as we dialogue through these different things. Next week, we're going to talk about Whisper Down the Lane. Oh, man, you don't want to miss out on next week. I believe it impacts all of us. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you so much for all that you are doing. And Lord, we're diving into a huge, huge, huge subject. You're aware of it. And Lord, as we're a gathering of people that, for the most part, we believe you, we trust you. And Lord, to see that working itself out in every area of our life is what we struggle through and we're working on. So Lord, I pray that you just help us to understand this topic better. Strengthen our faith with this. Strengthen our beliefs, our understandings. And Lord, I pray that you'd help those that, Lord, they are taking steps away from you for different reasons. I pray that you'd help them to see why and where they're going. Lord, for no other reason than for them to make clear and honest decisions. Lord, thank you for our time together this morning. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.